The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Thank you to everyone who supports this show and all of the shows on the Major Spoilers Podcast Network. If you're not already, you can become a Major Spoilers member by signing up at patreon.com/majorspoilers.
The Major Spoilers Podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Ashley.
And I'm Steven, and you're listening to the Major Spoilers Podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans.
In this issue, watch for falling crowbars and keep your jokers in the overhead storage bin. It's time to talk a death in the family. And the Batman would never be the same again. Plus, we'll round up the latest pop culture news, talk comics with the latest pop culture reviews, and set up the best jokes and all the assessments and feedback to use Burma Shave. It's the whole wheat, everything bagel of podcasts. So thank Conan for inventing them in 2018, because the Major Spoilers Podcast is on the air for nearly the 900th time.
Welcome to issue 842 of the Major Spoilers Podcast. Thank you so much for downloading. Thank you so much for checking us out. And yes, thanks you, Conan, for inventing podcasts.
Conan. Well, he went back in time.
I mean, anything's possible in this day and age.
Do you remember when you thought up the Major Spoilers Podcast and a strange, gangly, red-haired man went, "Hey, Steven!"
I mean, it's coming back to me now, but...
It's all coming back to you now. It's like those Doctor Who crossovers, the multi-doctor episodes, where the third doctor is like, "Wait, I remember this now." That's what happened.
842 episodes. How do we get this far?
Well, I think it's a combination of dogged determination and bullheaded stupidity.
Probably a bit of both. Yes, I would agree with you on that. Hey, let us talk some news. D23 just wrapped up in Los Angeles, or Anaheim, I guess, is more specific.
He's my favorite Star Wars character.
Marvel also gets a radio station, and we're going to get more Matrix all the time. Let's spin that wheel of destiny. Let's see where we land. Around and round. And around it goes, and there it lands with Marvel at D23. Disney's D23 Expo took place over the past weekend, and Marvel was there. They talked a little bit, and I mean a little bit, about some of the things that they revealed at the San Diego Comic-Con. But Ashley, they came to the table with a bunch of new stuff.
Yeah, I mean, a bunch of new stuff that hasn't been talked about that everyone kind of already knew was coming, and the same footage that they showed a month ago at San Diego Comic-Con, but with like a couple extra frames in it.
Well, we got to see Hayley Atwell as Captain Britain in, or I guess, what is her
Captain
title?
America.
Captain, well, I mean, she's got the British flag on her Captain America shield.
I don't know. I wasn't there, so I've only seen that piece of art.
Okay. We also found out Black Panther
Captain
2.
Carter.
Oh, Captain Carter. There you go. Black Panther 2 coming out in May of 2022.
Yeah, the Black Panther announcements and then the three new previously unannounced shows, I think, were kind of the newest ones.
Yeah, let's talk about those previously unannounced shows. First up, Ms. Marvel, Kamala Khan, getting her own series debuting on the Disney Plus. A lot of this stuff appeared to be Disney Plus announcements. But Kamala Khan getting her debut on the Disney Plus service when it launches sometime soon. I've gone to their site multiple times, still can't sign up, but I've been notified of when it will be available. But what do we know about the Ms. Marvel series there, Ashley?
Nothing except that it's going to be about Kamala Khan.
Also, well, one thing that they did announce was that she's going to make her debut on the Disney Plus series, and then she'll be part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which I find fascinating.
Well, you know, but they say that, and they done did say that before, about a bunch of characters, and the only one who's ever done it successfully to date is James Darcy. So I hope that's true, but Marvel has made 6 shows, 7 shows six of which no characters have crossed over from that weren't already a part of the MCU.
Right.
So I hope they do, but I'll really believe it when I see it.
I'm excited for this show for a number of different reasons. Number one, that it is Kamala Khan, and it'll be interesting to see audiences' reaction to her. I am somewhat concerned about stretchy effects.
Yes, always a concern.
Because those can go horribly wrong. I mean, Matthew, you probably still have nightmarish flashbacks to Mr. Fantastic pool noodle arms from back in the old original Fantastic Four movie. You've never seen that one?
I have.
Oh, okay.
I actually have flashbacks from Ralph Dibny in the latest season of Flash.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, there you go. That's another one that's also problematic. So we're getting Ms. Marvel. So all three of these announcements, no actors announced, no release dates announced to our knowledge. But if you go back and look at the graphic that we had from the San Diego Comic-Con, you could probably figure out where some of these things are going to plug in. Next up, we have a live-action She-Hulk series.
Yeah!
What are you excited about with She-Hulk, Matthew?
Yeah! I like the She-Hulk! She-Hulk is one of those characters who never gets her due. And if you, I've said this before. If you really enjoy your some Deadpool, I like how Deadpool talks directly to the readers and the people in the show. She-Hulk done it first. She-Hulk is a Simpsons did it for a whole lot of modern comics. And I really want to see them do something good with her. I'd love to see them take on the Dan Slott run, where she's working as a lawyer.
Single green female.
Yeah, working as a lawyer in the crazy world of comics where, you die and then you come back from the dead and you have to figure out with your probate lawyer what happened during the 2 years that you were dead.
Or
your alternate universe self came through and killed somebody, and can you be held liable?
With the whole, what are they calling it, the snap? That could be a couple of the first episodes dealing with what happens when you come back from the snap and someone else is occupying your apartment. Oh, wait, it's not going to be Aunt May and Spider-Man, though. Shoot. Darn. Oh, forgot about that. Question. How many of you think that we're going to see Mark Ruffalo appear in the She-Hulk series at all? Or are we just going to pick up in media res where She-Hulk is already big and green and doing her lawyering thing?
Interesting.
I'd like to see Ruffalo. I think there will be references to Ruffalo, or there will be references to Bruce. But I don't know if we're going to get it. It'd be great to get Ruffalo. But once again, it's kind of like the issue with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., where they're like, hey, we're going to do all these wacky, wild, weird things with Ghost Rider and, the Immortals and the Inhumans. And, the movies have decided they're not going to play with us anymore. So
Ashley, same question.
I think the chances are slim to none that he'll appear. He's not a traditionally I do TV guy, which doesn't mean that he might not be open for it. And I think if we do see him, it will be as Bruce. I don't even think it'll be as the Doc Green amalgam that we have right now. I think we would see him in a flashback.
Okay.
And
what's Eric Bana doing these days?
Well,
honestly,
I don't think they'll do that.
Eric Bana is great. And that movie did him so dirty. He was so good as Hector in Troy, and that movie also did him so dirty.
What about Ed Norton? I know Ed Norton hasn't worked in like 5 years.
Well, have you ever seen the interviews that he gave on the red carpet?
It's not nice.
He a monster.
I don't think he's coming back to
a tremendous actor, which is unfortunate.
Oh, yeah.
But ultimately for me, it's nothing to me whether or not Bruce is involved in the show, because I think She-Hulk SVU is great.
Yes.
And I'm here for it. I hope they cast Lucy Lawless or someone who could crush my head with her thighs. Like, that's what I'm here for.
Yeah.
I'm not here for her cousin.
I'm curious. You made the comment about, how the television universe and the MCU are supposed to be integrated. And they've said that Kamala Khan will be one of those characters that crossover. We saw in the Netflix shows that every time they would be talking about anything in the greater MCU, they always would refer to the incident or make a passing reference, but not actually name call anything out. Do you think now that everything is under the Disney umbrella and it's not a Netflix series? I know ABC with S.H.I.E.L.D. and they kind of tried to do that. Do you think we'll get a tighter integration between MCU and Disney Plus TV shows?
I honestly hope not, because I don't want to watch all of these shows.
I think we'll see it at the beginning. But I also think that the first time that Feige or whoever is running Marvel Studios wants to do something that the shows have already done, they're just going to go ahead and bulldoze whatever it is and say, okay, fine, that didn't happen. But I don't think, and this is, you know, I said this about the movie series and I was proven wrong. I don't think that it is entirely feasible to expect that all of these shows are going to fully integrate with a theoretical Marvel universe, because we've already seen in the, 22 movies, however many it is that Marvel has done, we have seen moments that completely bulldoze existing continuity between the films without even intending to, without even thinking about it, you know, because in that first Iron Man movie, Phil Coulson introduces himself as coming from this new agency. We're working on the name, just call us S.H.I.E.L.D. And now we found out, well, they've been S.H.I.E.L.D. since like 1994, and Peggy created them in the 50s. And it's just, it's a thing where, as an ongoing concern, I think you're going to have to take the Marvel Studios output the same way we take the Marvel Comics output, which is to say,
reboot
whatever
it
is. Well, no, whatever it is that they say currently matters. And the rest of it may not. And a story that you love may have to be phased out simply because the time frame no longer works. And, you know, Howard the Duck can't have been around in 1976 to come and run against Jimmy Carter for the presidency. And if it's not Jimmy Carter, the story doesn't work. So the story can't have happened like that.
Ashley, any thoughts beyond what you've already shared?
Beyond, I hope not. I think Matthew probably hit it spot on with they're going to do it in the beginning until it gets too convoluted or too inconvenient.
Okay.
But I will say, as someone who is a fan of tie-in media and tie-in properties, I do think that your content should stand on its own. I don't think that you should have to have read the Holdo novel in order for their Star Wars, whatever the last one was, to be any good. And I don't think if you should have to have watched all of these Disney Plus series in order to make sense out of what the future of the Marvel Cinematic Universe of movies are going to be. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very delicate balance, and Marvel has not achieved it so far, which is not to say that it cannot be done and that they will not do it. But I go in with trepidation.
Okay. The one show that they announced that is somewhat concerning to me is Moon Knight. Mark Spector, Moon Knight.
Mm. How so?
So Moon Knight, Batman turned up to 11, right? A little bit maybe more violent, a little bit more dealing with some...
That is an extreme oversimplification of Moon Knight, and it's the internet talking.
Schizophrenic, multiple person personalities, which we've already kind of seen in Legion, right? But they have stated that everything on Disney Plus is going to be PG-13 or below. And Moon Knight has kind of always struck me as something that is kind of like the Daredevil series that we saw on Netflix. Something a little bit more graphic, something a little bit more intense, something that's probably going to not be afraid to utter a bad word every now and then. And so I'm wondering what happens as this lands on a Disney Plus service.
Well, here's the thing about Moon Knight. In the year 1975... when Moon Knight debuted in the Marvel Universe.
What was it? Werewolf by Night or whatever?
Everything is PG or less. All the way through probably about 1994, the relaunch, well, may have been closer to 90, the relaunch of Mark Spector Moon Knight, everything was PG. Even well into that Mark Spector Moon Knight run, you were working PG-13. You were working a little blue, but it was still mainstream Marvel Universe stuff sold on the comic racks. I feel like in recent years, since about 2006 or so, they have been leaning really hard on the crutch of Moon Knight is crazy and it's all adult and people get murdered and faces are smashed and people die and we say the F word. But that's not all the character is about. And much like, you know, much like the theory that people have that the Fantastic Four represent the classical elements, earth, air, fire, and water, and you can't do anything else with them. And if you're not dealing with that, and Reed's not a jerk, and the Thing's not a baby, and Johnny's not a hothead, and, you know, Sue is not an overarching shrew, it's not really Fantastic Four. That's not always what it has been. And I think that we've seen in the case of things like, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy, we've seen in the case of their Cloak and Dagger and their Runaways stuff on TV, the Marvel Cinematic Universe isn't tied to what the modern sensibility or the modern expectation of that comic book character is. And I feel like Moon Knight has been an R-rated book for a lot less time than people think. And I think that there's a lot of good Moon Knight stories that can be told. Even if you're telling them G-rated, you can still tell stories with this character without having to resort to, I am the Batman, only I wear a white suit. Because Moon Knight is more than that. And he's been through a lot of different eras. And, you know, maybe the last 10 or 15 years, he's been kind of locked in a pattern that has gotten stale. I'd like to see them do something entirely new or even old school to the point where the new fans are mad about it.
So, no, but here's the good thing, right? How many people know the character? How many people know Moon Knight? Probably a lot less than that. So this does give Marvel the opportunity to do something completely different, to do something radically different. You know, maybe do some of those classic storylines. I mean, Daredevil was the same way, right? I mean, it was very violent, but they did touch on some of the classic moments from either a Frank Miller run or from whatever. But they also really push the boundaries of what you would expect from a Marvel television series. And my fear is with everything that they do on Disney Plus, people are going to come in expecting what they got on Netflix. But because Disney is like, no, this is going to be family friendly PG-13 or below, we're going to have a lot of people maybe disappointed in the long run.
But family friendly doesn't have to mean boring. It doesn't have to mean
No,
bad.
It doesn't. But I'm just saying, I think people are going to come in with the expectation of, ooh, remember what they did over at Netflix? That's what we're going to get on this, too, because it's not on broadcast television. And then I think a lot of people initially are going to be, whoa, this isn't what I thought it would be.
Well, I can see it, I guess. I feel like the thing about Moon Knight that is easy to forget because, you know, people give you the thumbnail sketch of, hey, he's Marvel's Batman. Moon Knight is a lot more complex than that. Moon Knight is a character who has been for decades canonically Jewish. So you've got someone coming from a different background than most of these guys who are just coming out of nowhere. He's a character who has multiple personality disorder, and it gives them a chance to actually address being a superhero and dealing, you know, with issues, dealing with mental health issues, something that they could possibly actually do in a positive way, something we've never seen, except, you know, I am Batman. I am crazy for vengeance. They could do something deeper. They could play with those multiple personalities in a way that is entirely, you know, new audience friendly, younger audience friendly.
That could be the weird thing, too, because that Legion series on FX deals with multiple personalities, all residing in a single body kind of thing.
Yeah, but I think that's kind of a different, at least what I'm familiar with of the characters from the comics, because I've never seen the show, is a different take on it. Moon Knight is more like.
No, I know what you're. I mean, I know. I know what you're talking about. Ashley, thoughts on Moon Knight or thoughts on everything being PG-13 or below?
Well, the PG-13 has been a hovering question ever since Disney acquired Fox.
Right,
because
right.
Because everyone who loves Deadpool is reasonably concerned. I have never read Moon Knight. I know virtually nothing about Moon Knight. So I can't really speak to whether or not you could do a decent PG-13 version of that character, but I think this is going to be that first gauntlet. So it'll be interesting to see if they blink or not and hold that PG-13 line. Mm-hmm. But Disney is very protective of that mouse brand and that, quote, Disney image, unquote. So I think people might be surprised what they're willing to hold the line on.
The entire MCU to date has been PG-13.
Yes.
Captain Marvel, Deadpool, Black Panther, Avengers, Ant-Man, all PG-13. So it's not like you can't.
Oh, no, I'm not saying you can't. At no point did I ever say that. I'm just saying that.
I wasn't talking to you.
No, but people are taking that reading. People online are definitely taking that reading.
Yeah, it's there.
Yeah, no, I will be very interested to see when this happens. I wish they would open up the sign up window so we can get in there and get signed up. I cannot wait.
I think the only thing that we know right is November, because we know that that's when The Mandalorian debuts.
Yeah, but I'm hoping they're not expecting everyone to sign up on November 11th. I'm hoping that.
Well, they also, and no one is talking about this, they have not informed us upon which platforms we are to access this app. Everyone is assuming we're getting a Netflix level rollout where you can get this. Is Disney going to allow their Disney Plus service on a Sony PlayStation
or on an Apple TV? Yeah,
exactly. Or is this going to be more like a DC Universe where you can only get it in the United States and you could only get it on your internet browser?
Well, we do know that they did announce.
I don't think it'll be that, but that could possibly happen.
Right. They did announce some of the rollout dates for other countries, just not here in the United States for some of that stuff. I know that they were taking some early signups at D23. For people that wanted to get in for that, like the DC Universe that you can get on your computer, you can also get the DC Universe app for Apple TV. Now, I don't know about Roku or PS4 or Xbox or
Roku
any of that other stuff.
Roku and Apple are the only ones. You're correct. I don't have either of those, so in my mind, they don't exist.
Right. No. That's true. So, I mean, it very much could be that as well. We don't know. I would think that Disney would want to have their service in front of as many devices as they possibly could, but Disney wanting to be absolute controller of something, if there's ever going to be, and I could see them doing in-app purchases. There's no way that they're going to do it through Apple with the current situation between Apple and Disney and others. And there might be some providers that may be a little bit bitter that, you know, they yanked all of their services off of, you know, all their programming off their services, like all the Disney animated movies, I believe, are now gone off of the Apple iTunes service, to where you can't buy those anymore unless you've already purchased them.
I believe you are correct.
So I'll be interested to see what happens with that. There are ways around doing in-app purchases where you go to the website, you make a purchase, and then you can access it on your Apple devices. Hulu, I think, does a very good job right now of being kind of everywhere, and that's completely Disney owned at this point. So I think Disney's going to try to put this out on as many platforms as they possibly can. And I'm sure they're actively working with people for those agreements. So I don't know. We'll see. But I will say I'm definitely signing up for this service because I saw that Mandalorian trailer again, like for the 20th time. And I'm totally down for that series. I cannot wait to see what happens.
You've always loved those cars since Back to the Future, so.
Yes. Different DeLorean there. It's totally.
It's not the story of John DeLorean and how he made a car out of aluminum foil.
Actually, there is a new, is it a TV series or a movie called The John DeLorean Story, which
the
goes
man
in
DeLorean.
Yes. And this movie goes into the whole thing, including the bankruptcy of the company and all that stuff. So I'm kind of interested to see that.
How he invented the Pinto.
Yeah. All right, everybody, you can head over to majorspoilers.com and let us know what your thoughts are about some of these big announcements that Marvel made. And of course, Ashley did a more complete rundown of everything that happened at D23, including a bunch of Star Wars stuff in a special Did You Hear post that you can find at majorspoilers.com. A lot of Star Wars stuff in that one, as well as what else did you have in that one, Ashley? The Marvel stuff.
It was Star Wars and then all of the Marvel stuff. And the Marvel stuff is broken up into the television and the movie news.
There you go.
Again, on a broader view, sort of lack thereof for the most part.
I guess I wasn't surprised by any of that. I mean, I
was surprised because everyone was screaming about it. And I know that the three shows that were announced were great, but like the Loki news was like, we're making it. Mm-hmm. We have a director.
Yeah, WandaVision was the same way.
Insert crickets. Like, yeah, the WandaVision one was like, we're definitely ripping off that one cover from the Tom King run. You know, and I understand they have a lot of plates spinning. They have a lot of things. We can't get a Mandalorian trailer for everything. And obviously their focus was Star Wars. But when you look particularly at the Marvel announcements, I think from a macrocosmic view, they're not that impressive, with the exception of the three new slated shows and then the Black Panther air date, of course.
Yeah. And I think they really kind of did reveal as much as they could at. I was expecting them to reveal some Phase 5 stuff, quite honestly, at D23.
Well,
but they didn't.
4-week turnaround, that's quick.
Yeah, but you know that they're working on that, all that stuff in the background. So it's just like, what are they ready to reveal publicly? And I think the Sony Disney Spider-Man thing was kind of overshadowing a lot of any major news that Marvel could have announced at the convention or at the event expo, I guess is what we're calling it. If you want to find out more about the Spider-Man Disney thing, Ashley and I had a pretty, I think, pretty good discussion about who is the bad guy in this entire thing. And I think a lot of people are starting to come around that maybe people shouldn't be as mad at Sony as everyone appears to be.
Yeah.
But you can go check that out on last week's Finally Friday over at our YouTube channel, youtube.com/major spoilers video. All right, let us jump into some reviews. And let's see, Ashley, why don't you talk to us about, what is this, Adorned by Chi?
Yes. So this is a really interesting project that I've followed for a long time. And I am going to speak about it a little bit in vagaries because I backed the Kickstarter. So it's up for pre-order for the general public right now. Adorned by Chi is primarily a clothing company. And I have a lot of they make really great nerd-inspired clothing of a lot of their shirts. They're female-owned. They are out of the Midwest, so they're really great. Jackie, who's in charge of them, she's awesome. And so last year, they kickstarted their debut graphic novel, which is called Adorned by Chi, which I was like, that's a weird name because that's the name of the clothing company. It turns out that Jackie, the founder of the company and also the writer of this book, is Nigerian, and Chi is a Nigerian word for one of their God forces. And if you are adorned by Chi, then you are blessed by God.
Ah.
And the graphic novel is basically the classic Japanese manga magical girl story that we all know and love from things like Sailor Moon and Cardcaptor Sakura and Ranma ½, but set in Nigerian mythology and against that background, which for someone like me, who is very white and knows nothing about Nigerian culture, not only is that a learning opportunity, but it provides a lot of amazing artistic things that I'm just unfamiliar with. And I think this book is so good. And so that's why I really wanted to talk about it here, because for me, it was like a merging of the familiar and the unfamiliar. And Magus Otto, who is the artist, very much draws this in a classic anime style, but obviously populated with African characters. The two lead characters are twin sisters. One of them is an albino. So there's a very cool visual of the light and the dark, and then their powers reflect that as they come into it. And the story is broken up into 5 chapters that are collected in this first debut graphic novel. And it is paced a lot like Sailor Moon. So in each of the original series of graphic novels from Pretty Guardian Sailor Moon, you're introduced to a new Sailor Senshi. So like first it's Usagi, and then it's Ami, and then it's Makoto, and then it's Rei. And they all come together in the end to form a team to fight a big bad guy, which is very, very cool. It's set at Peace University in Nigeria. So everybody who's here is not only a member of Igbo culture, but they're incredibly smart and incredibly capable young women. And then, of course, there's a magical boy. And I really appreciate that they are powerful and they are intelligent and they are strong both in and out of their magical selves. That's something that magical girl stories didn't always have when they started out. So it definitely marks it as a more modern take on that arc. The only thing that I have against this book, the only negative thing that I have to say, is that by the end of it, the team has just met for the first time and they've taken down a big baddie, and I was like, great, but I would like more, please. This 120 pages is not enough, please. Can I have more? Because I thought it was so awesome. And Kickstarter books, and I say this as someone who has funded all of my graphic novels through Kickstarters, they're sometimes a mixed bag. You can tell that Jackie and Magus and this creative team definitely had a really strong point of view, and that they had an incredible editor working with them, because it doesn't read like sometimes debut comics read, like someone learning how to write a comic. This feels like it was professionally created, because obviously it was, despite being self-published. And I think it's such a wonderful example of what the Kickstarter economy also allows us to bring into the world, because I don't know where you would take this book to pitch it if she hadn't had such a strong audience and support to begin with. I really want to encourage people to check it out. Check out Adorned by Chi online. Check out their Instagram. The graphic novel, if you're not a Kickstarter backer, is available for pre-order, and it is supposed to start shipping out in August. I know that's a little bit more work and that's a little more nebulous than going to a traditional publisher or going to your comic book store and ordering it, but I believe in supporting independent comics, and I do like to shout them out here, especially as somebody who produces my own independent comics. So I would really recommend checking out Adorned by Chi, the graphic novel. You can get it through their website digitally or in print. And if you're like me and you're of a similar cultural background and similar taste, I think you'll really, really get a lot out of it. I think it's a really special story and I want them to make more of it. So please go and pre-order it.
There you go. Go check that out. Pre-order now, I guess final order cutoffs. Is this something that comes out in November? Or when does this come out if people are pre-ordering this now?
The website says end of summer, so I would assume they're going to start shipping in September or October.
Well, order it from their website then. That's what you want to do. Okay, cool. It's not in previews catalog or anything like that.
No, it is like truly self-produced. AdornedByChi.com or the Google will take you there, of course.
There you go. All right. Thank you for that, Ashley. This week, I am reading Detective Comics 1010 from DC Comics, Peter J. Tomasi and Christian Deuce, I believe is his name, on the art. This is one where I'm jumping in into the middle of a story arc where apparently a Deadshot has brought down a plane full of rich people and he's holding them hostage or he wants to kill them. I'm not really entirely sure what his motive is, but Bruce Wayne, who just so happened to be on that same plane, got sucked out and was picked up by these. The plane has crash landed on this an island that time forgot, essentially. And these two strangers pick up Bruce Wayne. And as he's starting to recover, they're telling the story of how they are forgotten soldiers from World War II that essentially did a whole enemy mine thing for years on this island. And they've grown accustomed to one another and they're now friends, one Japanese, one American. And by the end of it, Bruce Wayne is better and he wants to go and take out Deadshot. And so he borrows some of their gear and he's essentially Batman, but a 1940s version of Batman in their old fighter gear. And they fight. And I don't know what's going to happen next. There was a cliffhanger, obviously. But the weird thing about this issue is it felt like I was reading a Batman tale from the 80s. Not quite KG Beast kind of tale, but it kind of had that kind of feeling, like one of these like very short. You know, the bad guy is coming into town or, you know, Bruce Wayne has to go and do something while, you know, protecting his identity without really revealing that he's also totally Batman.
Always a fun trope.
Always a fun little trope. Sure. I don't know. There's something about this story that I enjoyed reading because it felt like a classic Batman tale from the 80s. At the same time, some of the dialogue's a little awkward in places. That's the thing that I think is going to probably bring this down a little bit for me, but it was an enjoyable series. It is very straightforward. This is not trying to do some big mega event, something that's going to impact Gotham City for the next 40 issues. It's not some shocker where, you know, someone's neck gets twisted off at the end of the issue. It's just a straight up kind of classic Batman tale. And Detective Comics 1010, very fun. The art is fine. I'm going to give this one 3.5 slices of meatloaf out of 5. I think if you are a fan of the classic tale, you will enjoy this. I don't want to give too much away, but it is out this week from DC Comics. Matthew, you are jumping back into one of your favorites, the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. And I think, are we kicking off a new arc right here? Or is this the second part of a new arc where,
This is the third part of a new arc.
Okay. All right. So what's going on here?
So Mighty Morphin Power Rangers 42, I believe, is the third part of Necessary Evil, which is the first arc of Power Rangers to come out of the Shattered Grid crossover. There was a whole Beyond the Grid thing, which was really kind of awesome. This takes us back to Angel Grove, where the second team of Power Rangers from Mighty Morphin Power Rangers Season 2, you may remember that Zach and Trini and Jason were replaced by Adam and Rocky and Aisha, I believe.
Aisha,
I don't remember.
Tyler?
There was Aisha, and then there was Tanya, but it was Aisha. Anyway, new Rangers, awesome Rangers, doing Ranger-y things. But in the original series, the actors left the show because they wanted more money, and they were shipped off to the Peace Conference. Note the audible air quotes. Necessary Evil explains that whatever happened in that universe, in this universe, those three Rangers have actually shipped off on a secret mission for Zordon, and they are super secret space ninjas.
Oh.
Who call themselves the Omega Rangers.
Oh, I thought they were going to be the espionage squad.
No, you're thinking of the Legion. But the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, under the leadership of Tommy the White Ranger, are still in Angel Grove. They're still putting their stuff together. And they're being watched by an alien bounty hunter named Dane. Dane's name is a joke because he's of the same dog race as Doggy Kruger. So he's a Great Dane. Get it? Okay, so that's a thing. He's a red lizard dog or a dog lizard, perhaps. I'm not entirely sure. But we're actually getting two different frames of reference here. We get the Omega Rangers in space. They are being led by a blue emissary who is this weird multidimensional transitional creature made of all the blue rangers ever to go through the morphing grid. Back on Earth, Tommy is trying to teach the team some tactics and also have a really big romance with Kimberly. Steven, you'll like this issue. Kimberly goes running on the Great Wall of China, and she's wearing like this cute sports outfit. It's nice. You'd like it.
She look like Amy Cho Johnson?
Yes.
Hmm.
Sort of.
I don't know. I follow Amy Jo Johnson, so there you go.
Danielle DiNicolo, who I am now told is actually a man, and I thought Danielle was a woman nonetheless. Danielle does takes on these characters that are not photorealistic. So it's not like, this is clearly Jason David Frank, this is clearly Amy Jo Johnson, this is clearly David Yost. But they are clearly Tommy and Kimberly and Danny. I don't remember his name.
Bob.
I think his Joe name Johnson. Is
Billy.
Bob.
Billy.
Bob is his name. Oh, Billy.
Yes. So it's definitely the character, but it's not necessarily Amy Jo Johnson. So you will definitely see Amy Jo Johnson, but Amy Jo Johnson may not see herself. The thing that I really love about this is the Omega Rangers actually get to dress up in these really cool formal outfits, suits and dresses, and they end up in a fight. And Trini is in a fight wearing big yellow spiked heels, and she's fighting with one of her friends. They're like, so you always wear spikes for formal occasions? She's like, yes, spikier the better, just in case there's a fight. I really enjoy that. That's really awesome. And the stuff that's happening on Earth is really leaning into, I don't know if you guys have ever watched Power Rangers, but it kind of leans into the nonsensical parts of the show, the things that don't always make sense, and the fact that their tactics aren't really tactically sound. Sometimes the Power Rangers do dumb things and they win because of the power of it's their show. So it's interesting to see somebody actually trying to target that and deal with that. And if I'm reading this issue right, we may actually see an explanation for why a particular set of weapons disappeared in between Power Rangers Season 2 and Season 3 in universe, as opposed to the we ran out of Super Sentai footage explanation of our universe. Nonetheless, I don't want to give too much away because it does come out this week. And if you've been following, there are some big shock moments in here where you're going to be like, that's what that meant. But Four Slices of Meatloaf for Mighty Morphin Power Rangers number 42, written by Ryan Parrott, art Daniel DiNicolo. And all the Rangers are back and they're doing all Ranger-y things. And hopefully eventually we'll get to a point where everybody, whoever was a Ranger, gets to be in the comic books.
They already were in Shattered Grid, dude.
Yeah, but they weren't all there. You didn't get moments with everybody.
No. Okay.
You didn't get to see, you know, Emma from the Power Rangers Megaforce being like, hi, I'm Emma. Teehee. She was there. I mean,
sure.
We saw her.
Yeah. She was there. Listeners, we've got a bunch of writers writing reviews over at majorspoilers.com. And if you love comic books and you want to find out what our thoughts are and maybe what some comics you should pick up are, you can go check out all of those reviews. You can also check out Wednesday morning before your comic shop opens. You can find the Major Spoiler staff picks where members of the Major Spoiler staff let you know what books they are looking forward to reading this week. It's all over there at majorspoilers.com. This week, Matthew and I had a long conversation about this week's trade paperback, Batman, A Death in the Family, because we swear up and down that we have talked about this before.
Yeah.
But in the main Major Spoilers podcast, I've gone through and done the search through our feed and cannot find anything.
We cannot find it. So I think, and I think Stephen actually found a point where we were talking about the movie adaptation.
Maybe that could have been that.
During which we talked about the series.
Mm-hmm.
But if, in fact, we have done this before, I'd like to hear about it. And you guys tell us if our opinions have changed.
Yeah. So Batman and the Death in the Family. Let's do the geek history lesson people do. Let's do this.
Okay.
Let's do this whole meet cute thing where was the first time you read Batman, A Death in the Family? And Matthew, I think you're probably the first person to run into A Death in the Family.
Yes, this is the comic book that got me in trouble with my mother. A Death in the Family came out in like 1981.
Like 86, seven? I want to say 86, 87.
Something like that.
88. We're old. December of 88.
All right. So I would have been 17. I would have been a senior in high school, which tracks because I remember the city I lived in and the fact that I lived with my mother at the time. And here is the thing. A Death in the Family was originally a book that came out. I bought it off the stands, probably at the Pomida, which may have been a TGNY in Russell, Kansas. But in the Death in the Family book, there was actually a 900 number that you could dial to vote whether or not to kill a character in the story. It was this big interactive to-doot, and everybody was like, oh my God. You could, you know, go through and you call the number on the ballot. What they didn't tell you was it cost money. And so when the phone bill came around and my vote was on there, I got in trouble because the implication was that I had called a different type of phone service that cost money.
Ah.
But that's neither here nor there.
So for me,
I met it in 88 off the stands.
So for me, I also came into it, but I came into the fourth issue of the Death in the Family story arc because at the time I was just slowly starting to get into comics. And there was a big newspaper article about DC Comics is going to kill Robin. And my mom showed it to me. I was like, what is this? And so over the next couple of weeks, maybe the next couple of months, I was not only tracking down, I'd gotten the final issue of this series, but I started to track down the issues that preceded this. And I had to go to like four or five different comic shops. Yes, in the 1980s, there were a lot of comic shops around. Heck, there were like two or three in Topeka alone during this time period. And I had to go to several in both Topeka and Lawrence to try and find all of the issues leading up to this monumental event. And then it suddenly made a whole lot more sense to me as opposed to just reading the final issue and going, huh, well, how did this happen? So that is my introduction to Batman, A Death in the Family. Ashley, what about you? When were you introduced to Batman, A Death in the Family?
Probably around 2006 when I was in high school. I bought it from the local comic book store because I didn't know a lot about Jason Todd, except he was the one what died.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been around the time or not too long after he done Undied. So I thought,
oh, right.
I should figure out how he died. And I love a Perez Wolfman, anything. They're great. And then Tom Grummett, one of my all-time favorite unsung artists who I was not familiar with at the time, but became familiar with because of this book. So I knew I was going to dig this because I had already read New Teen Titans up to this point. And I did.
So we have kind of read the issues leading up to A Death in the Family. In fact, I think the last time.
The ones that kind of follow.
Yeah, come after this, right?
Line.
Yeah. So
yeah,
the last. Yeah. So after the last couple of years, we've gone through everything but touch on this issue. So we should go back and find out what all the issues were, the episodes were, and then you should play those in order and you'll hear our discussion of this entire series from beginning to end. But Batman Death in the Family essentially has the Joker escaping from prison, and Batman is going to track him down. The Joker steals one thing that I had completely forgotten about this series is that the Joker has a nuclear cruise missile in his arsenal that he's just going to dismantle and fly off to, where is he flying off to? Iran?
Iran, yeah.
He's going to fly off to Iran. And Batman's going to fly overseas to track him down with members of the government. Meanwhile, Jason Todd has been put in timeout because he's going to a little bit too far. And as we saw in the issue preceding this volume, This is the preceding this volume is where Jason Todd, the guy, jumped or he slipped by accident.
Yeah. And which is a classic Batman trope by this point.
Yeah. He quote unquote fell. And it's kind of left unanswered whether he, you know, pushed him or threw him or just didn't help him. But Batman's kind of had enough of this. And he's like, Robin, you are in timeout. And Jason Todd is like, oh, OK, I'm kind of sad now. I'll go back to my old neighborhood, which just so happens to be the same place that Batman's family was killed. And this old woman is leaning out the window going, you, Jason Todd, aren't you Jason Todd? I got to pack a big old box of your junk. Get it out of my apartment. And he goes back to the Batcave. And as he's going through all the stuff, he finds his original birth certificate and discovers that the woman he thought who was his mother is not his mother at all.
Yep.
And he goes on a 4-issue quest to go find his mother. One of the women he thinks is his mother is Lady Shiva.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yes and no, right? Because doesn't she and...
She later becomes Cassandra Cain's mother?
Yeah, Cassandra Cain's mother. And so it's like, wow, that's kind of weird. So there is... And then there is someone who is actually involved with Joker's mob. The first woman.
Right.
And then the third woman that he meets, who's this, you know, very... blonde-haired, you know, doing good for the people of Ethiopia. I think, is this... Yeah, they're in Ethiopia at the time. And just, you know, doing good, doing medical aid. And this, Jason Todd discovers, is his real mother.
Dun, dun, dun.
But she's got a darker secret, Ashley. What is that dark secret?
That she likes the drugs.
She's been stealing money from the aid organization that's supposedly aiding people.
Yes, and the Joker knows all about this, and he gives her a proposition. Hey, put in some of my Joker drugs inside of your drugs, or I'm going to let everyone know about your embezzlement and your drug use and all this stuff. And she's going to go along with it, and Jason Todd finds out, and he's like, but Mom, I'm Robin. I can't let you do this. I'm going to save you. And then Joker walks in and beats Robin to death with a crowbar, and then to make matters worse, he blows him up, too.
He's not actually dead from the crowbar. He's up and standing right before the bomb goes off. But
which, you know, in that sequence, it is pretty brutal. Even today, as I was reading through this, I mean, today, meaning as in this week, as I'm reading through this volume again.
No, he means today.
Literally today, 5 minutes before the show.
And you get to that page where the Joker is just beating him to death with a crowbar. It is super uncomfortable.
It is. Because you're looking at a 15-year-old kid being killed by, you know, a psychotic person who, by the way, is creepy, creepy, creepy with these pencilers, especially when he's wearing regular flesh tone makeup.
Oh, man.
Talk about your uncanny valley. Good Lord.
Adrian Roy, who is the colorist of this issue.
Crushes it.
Yes, it's very, very good. But this isn't the first time we've seen the Joker in flesh colored makeup, is it?
No, no.
Okay, because it is, first of all, it's Jim Aparo doing the pencils on this. And this is classic long chin Joker. And he does his best to make sure that the Joker's mouth is never closed so that you get that big giant grin. But when his mouth are closed in a couple, there's like maybe 4 panels in all this entire trade where his mouth is actually closed. And it's creepy. And then on top of that, you're putting on the flesh colored coloring on the skin. And it's just creepy.
He looks like the devil. He does.
I wonder, though, Ashley, so much of the time the Joker's mouth is open, it almost makes him
lies.
Yeah, it almost makes him sometimes makes him a little bit more of a dullard, right? Because he's just got his jaw just hanging open. I just kind of expect, you know, somebody draw a little slobber coming out of the corner of his mouth or something at times.
Oh, I don't know. I find it super creepy because I have like a hang up about teeth and nightmares of my teeth falling out. So this era of the Joker that later really inspires Tim Sale's Joker with too many teeth crammed into his mouth, I don't find it to be a sort of a implicit lessening of the intelligence. I find it really scary.
And the Joker should be scary. I mean, he's going through and he is literally saying, I'm going to go poison a bunch of kids with my Joker drug. I mean, that's horrible. And then on top of that, before Jason Todd gets killed, they're going to break up this sale of this cruise missile to, I guess he's, is this take place? And this is in Ethiopia, right? Where they break up the sale, or is it, I forget which country they're in.
I believe he's trying to sell it to terrorists in Lebanon.
Ah, Lebanon, yes. And they break that up, and of course, the main guy is ready to bomb Israel with this thing immediately after he purchases it. The one thing that you forget is that the Joker, while he may be a genius with the chemicals, maybe so not so much with the mechanical, because he doesn't know how to put the cruise missile back together, and it blows up and kills all the bad guys. So I thought that was kind of funny.
On purpose.
Maybe,
he's
probably.
Just an agent of chaos.
He truly is. He truly is. So we get to the whole death of Jason Todd, and Batman is very broken up. Mm-hmm. And he's ready to go kill the Joker, but not yet, because now the Joker is the official ambassador of Iran. And the Shah of Iran makes an appearance in this comic book.
This for me is, having read this comic a couple times, I was like, this is weirder than I remember this being.
I know, right? I have a question, because very few times, well, maybe more so in DC Comics than maybe Marvel Comics. Well, maybe it's 50-50, where you don't see actual real people appear in the comics in their role, especially political. Yes, you get to see some presidents show up every once in a while. But to actually call out the Shah of Iran as a villain in your comics seems very risky on DC's part.
It does, and it feels I can't speak to whether or not this was accurate, having not been alive at the time, but it just feels a little tactless, whether or not the person that this character is based on is an awesome person or not. I know we love to put Hitler in comics and have Captain America punch him, but it feels strange by modern standards.
Yeah, what is your take on this? I mean, at the time, it's like, boo, Shah of Iran.
You're thinking of the Ayatollah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Shah was dead by this point.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead, Matthew. But yes, boo, whoever this person is.
Yeah, this is very, I don't think it's as egregious as something like, you know, Frank Miller's Holy Terror, but this is very much here is a political bad guy that we have no problem showing in a complete supervillain light. And, you know, circa 1982, 84, 86, in that area, the Ayatollah Khomeini was a recurring real world figure that was kind of treated as villainous. You kind of see a similar take after the first Gulf War. You'll occasionally see Saddam Hussein would pop up, mm-hmm, or you would occasionally see, you know, takes after 9/11, you would see people actually put in the comics someone who was clearly old, what's his face with the beard. And I understand the point of it. And I think I understand, you know, that in 1988, this is right in the wake of The Dark Knight Returns, right in the wake of Watchmen. This is an attempt to carefully court a little bit of controversy and say, here's a real world political figure. Mm-hmm. So this is a story that's meant to be more real and more grounded. But it's also a murder clown fighting a man in a bat suit. And having, you know, Ayatollah Khomeini in it is really just an admission of, we, the creators, see this character as a supervillain and we're going to play him as such. And so it doesn't feel, I don't know if disrespectful is the right word, but it doesn't feel entirely genuine. In fact, I would say disingenuous may be the way it rings to me, because you have the moment where the Joker literally becomes the suicide bomber in the United Nations.
Right.
And then Superman is like, nope.
Yeah.
You got to love some Superman. I love the Superman.
Yeah. Sorry. I messed up the Shah and the Ayatollah. Yeah. So, you know, history, fun, great. Scary times.
Different guy, same country. Same,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. I always think of the Shah anyway. But that's right. You just, for so much of the issue, the Ayatollah is off panel until he pops up in just one panel and it's full on arted out. And then the next thing we see is Batman is back in New York going to the UN, and Superman's there to say, have you heard? Maybe you didn't hear. You're going to be mad. And then Superman saves the day and Batman takes down the Joker. It's just, it's a really weird ending to a death in the family. I mean, the whole Joker as the ambassador, and he's going to kill everybody. It just really is a weird ending.
It is. And it really does show that DC wasn't sure what they were doing in terms of the death of Robin, because this story is not about the death of Robin. It's about something happening to Batman in a way that's vaguely topical, and then Superman coming in and Batman getting angry and really building up that Superman, the post-crisis Superman-Batman conflict, which was kind of DC's thing in the mid-80s. It came to a head probably 1989-1990, but this is really at a point where the story was that Superman and Batman did and always had hated each other's guts.
Right.
So when Superman comes and steps in, what this really is a story that if you are in Batman's head and you're like seeing the loss that he's gone through, this is Batman in a dark place and Superman coming in and ruining everything by being a big old overbearing jerk. Kind of like what we see in The Dark Knight Returns, with the exception being that Superman in the mainstream DC universe of 1988 was still a standalone hero on his own. So yeah, it's a balancing act that doesn't quite work for me.
I was going to say that I actually think the DC animated movie does a better job at distilling down the story of the death and then, of course, later resurrection of Robin and its impact than maybe reading this and reading Under the Hood back to back.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know, because the animated movie I was not super thrilled with, and I don't remember exactly why. Maybe because it was because in this DC animated universe,
give him Tim Drake's Robin suit.
Yeah, pretty much. But the way that the DC animated universe is working is now every movie is a continuation of the previous movie. So this is one giant continuing story that's going throughout. So by the time you get to the death of Robin, the death of Robin or the Under the Red Hood should have happened years before, but they're trying to make it modern and trying to make it updated for like right now. And it just feels really weird whenever I watch that animated movie. But this still, the death in the family also seems very out of place. Even today, reading it, it just seems weird. And it just seems like we don't know what to do with Jason Todd. We painted ourselves into a corner with, is he a good guy or is he a bad guy? Hey, why don't we let the fans decide? Of course, the fans won't let him die. And then they're like, oh, crap, the fans want him dead. They really hate Jason Todd. Of course, without Death in the Family, though, Ashley, we would not get the greatest Robin of all time.
That's true. And honestly, I believe the most interesting thing Jason Todd ever did was die.
Yeah, I think you're right.
When he starts as Robin, like when you read Crisis on Infinite Earths, people might not realize, but that's Jason Todd Robin, because Nightwing is also running around. He was just Dick Grayson for a long time, and it was the darker exploration of his character that made him really interesting. The crowning jewel of which is his resurrection, and unfortunately, he's kind of fallen into our Tim Drake camp where, for my estimation, they don't really know what to do with him because they also don't want to let him not be a hero. So even though I think by a modern standard, this collection is weird, I still think it's a pretty good Jason Todd story.
It is. It's kind of the iconic Jason Todd story. Mm-hmm. But the reason for that is this is also emblematic of post-crisis DC, because they did everything with Crisis on Infinite Earths that streamlined the universe and put everything together on one Earth. But then it came to a point, and you know, we've seen this again and again, like in 2011, we've streamlined the universe. We've made all these changes. We're going to tell these stories about how we got to that point. But then we also don't know where to go from here. And Jason Todd is one of those remarkable cases of two equally dumb and non-workable histories, because pre-crisis, 1984, 85, 86, Jason was basically just another Dick Grayson. Post-crisis, Jason was a completely unlikable little criminal jerkwad, and neither character was entirely palatable. They went too far in the opposite direction, And then when it came to the point where I remember being in the audience and going, yes, please kill him with sticks. And I voted to kill Jason Todd, and it cost like $295 and I got in trouble. But it's something where they had created this character, then they reworked the character, and then they realized that there's not really anywhere to go with that. It's that open-ended versus closed-ended storytelling that we keep seeing over and over and over. Robin is a little psychopath. What are we going to do with that? We're going to tell a couple of arcs, then we're going to kill him to make Batman really sad. And that's a lot of what happened in these 80s stories, where they wanted to make sure we weren't doing boring, air quotes, pre-crisis stories, but they also wanted to give us some change, some conversion of the characters into something new. We wanted to see some progression in the DC universe, which is how we get Nightwing as a, you know, a mid-20s solo hero, and then Robin hanging around with Batman still in play. So it really is an example of DC trying to have their cake and eat it too, and then not realizing that they didn't know what was in the cake, and it's actually guacamole and, you know, clams and tabacchi, and it's not really palatable. So his death here is, to me, really kind of the shadow of things to come. All of the event comics that we saw throughout the 90s into the modern day, all of the stories where X is going to die, someone dies tonight, we've killed the Fantastic Four, how long will they be dead? Nobody knows. All of it kind of falls here, because we're trying to get away from that old school storytelling, but we also can't really fully commit to something new and different, because then your comic books end, all your characters are dead, and nobody has any fun.
Yeah, so the actual book that you can get for Death in the Family. Now, Death in the Family only ran, four issues?
Four issues,
426 to 429.
Just like a Lonely Place of Dying.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Four issue arcs were all the deal in the 80s.
I really like that, to be honest with you. You can tell three main stories in a year.
You don't have that slowdown in episodes 3 and 4 that right. you have in a 6-issue arc.
Right. And it moves very quickly. Now, the collection that you can get that has the Perez Wolfman and Jim Starlin stuff. Jim Starlin is the one that wrote the Batman issues. But you can get Batman 426 to 429, also 440 to 442, the new Teen Titans, or the new Titans 60 and 61, and Batman Annual number 25 are all collected in that bigger volume. So you're going to get more of the fallout and more of the story that it's expanded upon in the other books. But the main four issues is what we're talking about this week. So you're getting a lot of death in these four issues.
In this family.
In the family.
Yeah. Yeah. I came in at the end of Jason Todd, so I didn't have to do a whole lot of Jason Todd reflection. He was dead. He was just the MacGuffin to move the story along. And then we went for, a couple of years with Batman on his own until Tim Drake showed up.
A couple of years. Well, Tim showed up almost immediately.
Yeah, as
he
the next door neighbor.
Yeah.
Until late 89.
Yeah, so he shows up as the next door neighbor kid who figures out from watching an old newsreel or something of the Flying Graysons, and then putting two and two together and then figuring out, my next door neighbor is Batman.
He real smart.
Yeah, he is real smart. He's the greatest Robin ever, ladies and gentlemen.
Honestly, the greatest Robin ever is the Earth 2 Dick Grayson.
Honestly,
it's a great costume.
I am not a fan of the return of Jason Todd.
The return of Jason Todd ended up being a shocking, oh my God, they said they'd never do this, how can they do this moment, which once again opened up storytelling platforms, but limited ones.
That's how we ended up with Thomas Wayne all over the place for a decade.
Wayne is terrible.
It is. And I honestly think Jason Todd really does not serve a purpose in the DCU currently right now. I think that it's a result of people who had a nostalgia factor for Jason Todd when he was alive.
Well, that's why we have Barry Allen.
Yeah.
And Jordan.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. So, I mean, it's really a shame that sometimes if a publisher is going to do something, I kind of wish they'd stick to their guns or crowbars in this case.
There's a little bit of cowardice involved. I mean, it's the same reason that we have like 8 Green Lanterns, the same reason that we have all of these different characters. You have Kid Flash and Impulse and another Kid Flash and the regular Flash and then the alternate Flash. It's they're not willing to alienate the people who want Jason Todd or Kyle Rayner or Jay Garrick. And so everybody's going to be around, even if it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Yeah. I like Jason Todd in specifically in the Grant Morrison runs where he is playing Red Hood.
Mm-hmm.
Where he is clearly a character who is ill-fitting in the Bat family, the Bat universe.
He's I agree.
The wrong kind of vengeance. And
yeah.
even Batman has to go, no, Jason, this is a step too far. That's a fun story that you can tell. You just can't tell it over and over and over and over.
Batman just needs to pull out the squirt bottle and spray Jason every time he's doing something wrong.
No,
Jason, no.
Bad. Oh, my God. I do maintain, though, because I do believe this of all characters, but even though Jason Todd has a lot of bad stories, I like him, and I think you can have him alive and do interesting things with it. I just, it's evident to me when you read the stories that the editors are and the publishers are not challenging or demanding the, you know, anything more than what's become the status quo. And that's too bad because he is a character where you can do challenging things with if you so desired to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I love the art in this. I think this is great. If you are wanting to read a major piece of DC history, reading Batman: A Death in the Family is probably a must read for you and your collection. I do have another question, though. What are your thoughts on putting real countries and real people into comics? I know right now we have, what is it, Balea? Is that it? Which is essentially the replacement for, what is it, Libya?
Well, Baalaya is actually kind of a composite. It's been Libya, it's been Iraq, it's been, you know, all
Kandak
sorts of different
does
things.
That a lot, too.
Yeah, and Kandak Kandak does the same thing. Yeah. What do you guys do? Would you prefer them, you know, name out a country like, hey, Israel or Iran or Iraq or whatever countries that they're in, Ethiopia, or would you rather comic books use made up countries?
Go ahead.
No, you.
Both being polite and Canadian. I have less issues with using a country than using a specific person.
Mm, okay.
But DC and Marvel both operate in this world where, you know, speaking of eating your cake and having it too, they want real locale, but when it does get too touchy, we'll just make this Markovia or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In fact, I wish it would be Markovia more because I'm sick of the Markovians being good guys. It's no fun at all, Young Justice Outsiders. But I wish whatever the publishers, I think they need to pick one because I think the flippity flop is confusing and it's a refusal to make a decision. And I would rather have the creatives make a decision, or the executives is who it would actually be, make a decision and have to stick to it ultimately.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Matthew?
I prefer made up countries and cities and characters for two reasons. One, it's the same reason that I'm always extremely leery of a character who represents a specific religion.
Mm-hmm.
Or Lord help us, a character whose powers come from their Christianity or
come from
the study of the Kabbalah or come from, you know, their personal relationship with, you know, Allah, whatever
it is.
Let's talk
about the Spectre then, shall we?
Oh, yeah. He's Old Testament.
The Spectre is a perfect example of what's wrong with it.
Yeah.
It feels trivializing. It feels disrespectful. And whether I share any of those beliefs or whether I am, you know, Iranian or Jordanian or Ethiopian, I can read this story and go, man, this feels very stereotypical.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd rather have it be stereotypical Baalaya Kandak. I'd rather have it be Metropolis. I'd rather have it be, you know, Midway City, that's a crap hole, rather than Kansas City. And I feel like, you know, Kurt Busiek actually did something brilliant in JLA Avengers that I loved, where they're on
the Earth is bigger.
Marvel heroes are on the DC Earth. They're like, this Earth is considerably bigger than ours.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
There are additional cities and even countries that don't exist in our world.
Yeah.
And I'm but yes.
So you're talking that way about DC, but do you also feel the same way then about Marvel? Because one of the things that People were always big fans about this stuff taking place in New York City, is you could go down to these areas and say, oh, this is where the Baxter Building would be, or this is
where. Yeah, but they're only fans of that because New York is portrayed quite well.
Yeah.
You know, New York is where all the heroes live. If New York were, to borrow Matthew's phrase, a crap hole, where all the bad guys lived, I think people would feel less warm and fuzzy about it.
That's actually the South Bronx.
I also have a problem with the real people being portrayed in this. I think, mm-hmm. I don't know if it was you, Matthew, or somebody else this week on Twitter had posted a thing with Superman and Nixon in panel together. And Superman's like, oh, don't worry, Mr. President, I will trust you with my, I don't know if he was giving his real identity away to
That's
President
actually
Nixon.
A fake panel. It was the JFK panel redrawn with Nixon.
Okay. But even then, that's could be problematic, right? In many, many different ways.
You know, Captain America beat up Nixon in the 70s at the height of the Watergate crisis. And Nixon committed suicide in an issue of Captain America. Mm-hmm. And while I love that story, I feel like, again, I don't want what Ashley wants, actually, when she says you have to pick one or the other. I literally want them to not pick. I want them to use as much of the made-up as possible so you can say a highly placed government official and not say Nixon. Even if you are Steve Englehart clearly saying that Nixon is the devil, you should be able to say that in a story in a way that doesn't overtly stab people in the eye with this being Nixon. Now, that said...
You're okay with the Ayatollah being portrayed as the way he's being portrayed here?
Not necessarily. I mean, the Ayatollah, I don't necessarily know all the politics of the 80s.
Oh, I'm not saying he was a good guy, and I'm not saying that we should be apologetic for the way he's portrayed in this, but, I mean, you run into these things, right?
The fair thing to do is to put the same standards on everyone's portrayal, right?
Right, right.
Exactly. The Ayatollah being in this as the equivalent of, you know, Rumon Harjavti from Bayalaya or the Queen Bee or, you know, Black Adam in Kandak in the later stories does feel trivial because that character is not the real world person. And the real world person did things that had real world consequences. So when you say Captain America punched Hitler, he sure did. He did that at a point where the world was about to go to war, and they did it for a point. And then later on, we saw presidents who clearly weren't Nixon or Johnson or Kennedy in the Marvel Universe as often as we saw Carter or Reagan or Nixon on panels. So I feel like whatever serves the story best is what you want. But in this case, the Ayatollah showing up was distracting, and it very much locks this into a period piece. This is very much an 80s, you know, Reagan era anti-terrorism story with a little edge of, you know, moms against drunk driving, or DARE, I guess it should be.
Yeah.
And as such, it will always be locked in 1987, 1988. Mm. You can't take this story away from that.
Yeah. So what's your final recommendation then, Matthew?
This is a thing. I like this story. I love Jim Aparo. I like this story less than other Batman stories of the same era. I like Jim Aparo less inked by Mike DiCarlo as he is here. I like Jason Todd. I don't like the way he dies. I still feel guilty about voting for him to die. This is really a check it out for historical reasons or if you really love Batman for me. Mm-hmm. But I won't tell you not to read it. I'll just say that it is a period piece and all of the, you know, the Zach and Rodrigo complaints about walls of text are here. The show don't tell rules that we like to complain about are here. And there are moments in this book that just completely date it. It's as 1987 as, you know, Miami Vice.
Yeah. Ashley, final thoughts from you.
Matthew is my brother and we don't agree on most things, but I think he summed this up absolutely perfectly. I think it's great for Batman fans. It's great for people who are interested in the time and the history of the story. I like the story a lot. Is it great? Maybe not. So if any of those are your yum, then check it out.
Yeah. All right, everybody. That wraps it up for this installment of the Major Spoilers Podcast. Thank you so much for being a part of everything that we do here. And we would love your feedback. Use the comment section over at majorspoilers.com to share your thoughts and reactions to this episode.
Or even better, you can send us an email to podcast@majorspoilers.com. And don't forget, you can support the show and everything we do by becoming a patron at patreon.com/majorspoilers.
Matthew, do you know what we're doing next week?
We'll be back next week, but I don't know what we're doing.
Harrow County Volume 5.
Yes! Oh, it's
gonna
get, read this one.
It's going to get scary, and we're going to have fun talking about it because we know that you love comics and we do too. And we will talk with you soon.
Bye.